Welcome to the For the Reef podcast. Each week we bring our fish nerd conversations from the fish room floor to your living room. We try to bridge the gap between the saltwater aquarium hobby and coral reef conservation. Now, here are your hosts, fisheries biologist and founder of For the Reef Apparel, Mitch Dender, with local fish store owner and first responder, Ian Bell.
Hey everyone, and welcome back. Today we're really excited to introduce Justine Curley from the Pittsburgh Zoo. Hello, Justine.
Hello.
Justine's an aquarist from the PBG Aquariums. I think that's the part that's what that area is called, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so we're just excited to have you on. Justine and I met a couple of years ago, I think now, at the Pittsburgh Zoo. For the Reef went there as kind of a guest, and we've kind of stayed in touch. So we're really lucky to have you on and share some of your aquarist knowledge.
Yeah, I'm super excited to be here. And I do feel like we're old friends. 2019 feels like a lifetime ago.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, especially with not being able to travel and everything. I mean, on a side note, I did get immunized yesterday, and that's pretty darn good for a Canadian.
Yay!
Yeah. So we're hopefully going to be opening up soon, and maybe we'll try and make a trip down to Pittsburgh.
Oh, we'd love it. We'd love to see you guys anytime.
So what's going on with the zoo right now? Are you guys open or?
Yeah, we're open. There's still limits to how many people can be in the buildings at one time. So we kind of lucked out because we really have one entrance and one exit point. So they just put someone, station someone at each one of those doors, and they have like a ticker counter, and then they radio people.
Got it. Nice.
It's worked. Like the aquarium is, we don't have the widest of hallways. It's more of like an intimate space. So it works, you know, and some people opt out of it, which is fine. And then some people kind of cut corners, which is fine too, just to like get through it. Mm-hmm. But we have penguins and everyone tends to like gather around the penguin window.
Yeah.
So there's that, that's a little bit of a bottleneck, but otherwise, you know, it's okay. They put stations for the touch tank. So, you know, kind of spread yourself out a little bit. It was definitely a learning experience, I think, for everyone. No one knew what this was going to be like opening back up. And it was weird to have people in the building again. Like, all of a sudden, I couldn't blast my music or just have all the doors open.
So
that was an interesting experience. But it's definitely nice to have money flowing back into the aquarium.
Yeah, for sure.
Because we can buy things again. That's nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, food can't be cheap.
No, I don't think people realize in a zoo, and we have marine mammals too, and I think those things eat more than like most other animals, which is wild.
Yeah.
But because, you know, shrimp's more expensive than hay, so there you go.
Touche. And still keeping a lot of live foods, as I remember, right?
Yeah, so we had cuttlefish, just the dwarf species, and when we were heading into, I guess, the first wave when we shut everything down, we really went through and said, okay, what tanks can we kind of shut down? We're not going to have people in the building, so what can we consolidate? What can we combine? What can we get rid of? And so the cuttlefish were like, we'll just throw them into this hodgepodge tank, see how they go. And they ended up doing pretty well and having babies, but we weren't going to pay to have grass shrimp shipped from Florida anymore. So I was like, okay, I'll just grow some. I'll be fine. So I started a hatchery and it actually worked.
That's awesome.
So I had enough growing that we raised cuttlefish, and we still shipped cuttlefish out during COVID to other aquariums. And now we kept 5 from the last batch. So we have 5 still on exhibit. But I think, insider info, I think we're going to switch that tank over to spiny lump suckers.
Oh, yeah. That's pretty sweet. Yeah. So like, where are the cuttlefish going to go?
Yeah. So these are an F5 generation. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that we'd push it much past that anyway. But if they had, like, we only had one female left too. So these are all guaranteed from the same female.
Yeah.
So if they had any, we could throw them back into that tank where they kind of made it on their own and just see what they do. But if not, we'll just let them live out the rest of their lives. And then put those spiny lump suckers in.
Nice. Nice.
Not to be excited about their, you know, demise, but yeah, you know,
cause that was like spiny a big thing. I remember when we were there and, so to give everybody a little bit of the backstory here, I was there with my wife and my little sister, who my little sister's not the most interested in aquariums and fish and all that stuff. But the thing that she actually talked about on the way home, apart from like the little cottage we stayed at and stuff like that, was the cuttlefish. So she actually thought those were pretty cool. And I remember, I mean, those were like your babies. I mean, I
do have a way of shoving them on to people. That's true. Yeah, that was crazy. I think we had, what was it, like 400 to 500 that we shipped out. So a lot of eggs, but a lot that we hatched out too. And I remember my boss at one point was like, this is a lot. And he was pretty concerned. But we had, they went to 11 different aquariums in 10 different states.
Wow. That's awesome.
We shipped them out far and wide. And that was from, those are probably F2s. I think that was pretty early on from the one batch. We got one batch of eggs from, I think it was Quality Marine that we ordered those from. So yeah, that was, it was pretty exciting, but that's what's really fun about this job is that it's ever changing.
Yeah,
you know, it, you just always get to try something new. So
and so how long do they usually live? It's an F5. I mean,
oh yeah, probably about 10 months, I would say.
These, oh, guys, okay, live. Mm-hmm. Oh, all right, so they're so, not, so that's how you get through these generations so quick.
So about every 6 months we usually have a new set of eggs from the batch, so they'll start breeding that I've seen usually around 3 or 4 months.
Right.
And you'll get eggs at like that 4 month mark. And what's always funny is if I've had 6 or if I've had 16 in a tank, they always like to lay their eggs in the same spot. They pick one and that's it. That's the spot.
And they like drop. Do they, is it like a, what do they do? is it like when they lay eggs? Yeah. Well, how does it work?
It's amazing. So these guys, not all cuttlefish species put ink in the egg sac itself, but the bendensis they do. So they come out and they look like really dark, like tiny grapes, I guess. And so you'll see the female and she'll just be working on it for a while. And you can't see a lot, right? Because those arms are in the way covering it. But then you'll see it when she just opens it up and deposits it and blasts back, and they'll wrap it. So it gets wrapped around and she'll do that like 40 more times.
Oh yeah.
You know, and then that's... she'll go hang out with the male, come back, do the same thing.
So we're obviously on a podcast here, so nobody can see you acting that out, but I was just thinking
to myself, the enthusiasm. You know, it's very obvious that you're excited about it.
Yeah, it's so it reminded me of back when I was working a lot with salmon. It used to be and this one other girl. She was a big time salmon researcher, and she was just as nuts about salmon as me. So we would be like, after a few drinks, we would do the salmon dance. And so you'd like emerge from an egg, and then you'd be digging your red. It just reminded me too much of that. Maybe we should post a video of this podcast just to show everybody how to show
everybody. Only if you do the salmon dance.
Yeah, well, I'll do the salmon dance if you do the cuttlefish dance.
All right.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
But I'm attempting to get some screenshots of you guys doing the dance.
I always go into these things like, okay, I'm going to sound like I'm on NPR, but I never do. I just sound like an excited child. Every time.
Well, I wanted to just back up a little bit, Justine. What's your background? How did you end up where you are?
So I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I should mention that. And landlocked, and we were not the family that went on beach vacation. I had a great childhood, just throwing that out there. We went camping every year. Had a great time. We just didn't go to the beach. So naturally I became obsessed with the ocean. And the only outlet I had for that obsession was to go to the zoo and the aquarium. And my dad, who is a gem, used to pull me out of school every year on my birthday and take me to my favorite place, which was the Pittsburgh Zoo. And it may be because I lived in Pittsburgh and it was December, or it may be because it was the coolest spot, but we always went to the aquarium. And I would just park myself down and watch. I watched the tanks. I was obsessed. I loved it. And so I decided that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to work, you know, with these people. And, you know, they meet kids all the time. Like, yeah, I know you want to be a marine biologist. Okay. All right. Yeah, I get it. So naturally I volunteered at the zoo when I was 14, and then I interned before going to college, and then I went to college down in Florida, and I studied marine biology, and I did cut class a few times and just go to the beach. I did. It was great. I couldn't think of anything else I wanted to do, because I think this was always what felt right. And I stayed in Florida the year after I graduated. I did intern at a couple places down there. And then I moved to Minnesota, because why not? Because it was January and I was too hot, you know? Mm-hmm. And I worked in the aquarium there and I loved it. But life took me to an aquarium in Ohio. And then eventually a spot opened up in Pittsburgh, and it was like, yeah, that's home. That works. So I ended up here about 5 years ago. Actually, almost exactly 5 years ago.
That's awesome. And that's so, it's always a journey like that, I find. So when we, like to become an aquarist, you really need to be a volunteer at aquarium, and then you kind of work your way to one, and then you kind of keep pushing your way through different aquariums. I remember when I was that was like a dream for me, was to become an aquarist in an aquarium. But in Canada, but in Canada, it's like,
come with me.
I know. It's so different over here, because like, it's like, okay, you can go to Toronto and try and get with Ripley's, or Vancouver has an aquarium, or there's a lot of like really small aquariums, but it's pretty tough.
I like Vancouver.
Yeah, Vancouver's amazing. BC in general is something else, but
they breed wolf eels, so if you want to go, I'm just saying, I'm down, we could go.
Yeah, maybe I'll just like knock into a door, bring the employer coffee, and say I'll scrub the bottom of the aquarium, anything that you need done.
For sure we'll pretend it's the 80s. You just call someone up, hey, you hiring?
That's right Sure. Okay. Like, you know Justine from Pittsburgh Zoo?
No,
she told me you'd hire me.
She likes wolf eels. Okay.
Yeah. And so I remember when we were there, I mean, you were just running around all day in your rubber boots. Is that still what day to day looks like for you as an aquarist?
I did get a new pair of boots.
Okay.
Now they're a new used pair, but they're new to me. So that's nice.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a lot of running around. So 20,000 steps is usually my average day at work. But it's a lot of heavy morning stuff, and you're usually just trying to do too many things at once. So coming in the morning and looking at everything is one thing, but then you have to make sure, like, right, I have to get all my live food set up for the day. So change out all the Artemia water, make sure that's ready to go. I've got to enrich stuff. I have some adorable baby peppermint shrimp right now.
Oh, do you?
I stare at longingly in the mornings. They grow every day. I swear they're a little bit bigger. And there's always fewer of them because they eat each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And but it's like a little tiny hunger game.
Yeah. Are they still, because they like do like the flap thing when they first are born, right?
They're hilarious.
Yeah.
So I have videos and they just tumble. Just tumbling in the water. What are you? How do you survive in the ocean? How do you make this work?
Seriously.
Huh. So they're hilarious. But they're starting to get, you know, like their color a little bit. So
do you find them funny. Difficult to
but breathe? when you shine a light on them, they all kind of bundle up together. Mm-hmm. And they're running into each other, like surprised that there are other shrimp there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are they difficult to breed?
Oh, no. She breeds. So the mated pair, we have a mated pair. And about every, I could check her chart, but I want to say it's every 3 weeks. Maybe a little bit more than that. But yeah, she's always full of eggs.
And do you separate them from the babies?
Well, so I'll take the mated pair from their tank where they live. And when I know that she's about to pop, and sometimes I'm better than others. So sometimes I'll get her the night of, and then sometimes I'll get her and she's like 4 days out, but I'll move them together. I move the pair together. I don't want to separate them because they're always together. Just feels right.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it normally takes her 2 nights to fully release all of her eggs. So we have a set of larval tanks in a row, and I'll put her in one, she'll release some, and then I'll move her out, put her in the other. And then in between, while I'm growing up the babies, any that she releases, I just keep on exhibit because we have a sea moth in that exhibit, and he really likes live shrimp.
Oh, nice.
So, I know.
That's awesome. And then you're feeding those guys the Nepal eye or the baby brine shrimp?
The peppermint shrimp I'll raise because they actually eat like Mahano anemones, and that's nice for us because we get those all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So they it's nice to keep like those down. Trying to brighten myself up a little bit here because I'm all dark. Oh, there we go. Oh, wow. Oh, boy. Sorry, we have these color changing lights and I don't really know how they work. Okay, got it.
We should have been at this one. This is great.
Yeah, I'm really good at technology. We have some lights, the LED lights that you can hook up your phone to.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do that. How do you guys do that? Do you guys make your lights change colors on your phone for your tank? Like this is a moonlight setting, this is a daylight setting.
Yeah, I definitely do that.
You do. I can't handle that.
Yeah.
I'm so proud of all of you. I can't do it.
So yeah. how many systems or what kind of things do you take care of? Like it sounds like you have a lot to do with sort of background breeding and stuff, but do you have some sort of specific tanks or creatures that are your responsibility?
Oh yeah. So all my background breeding, that's just me tinkering.
Okay.
Because if not, I will go insane. But so yeah, different things throughout the years that I've taken care of. My favorite things are invertebrates by far. Like my husband was just saying the other day something about, like, wouldn't you like to work with sharks? And I said, sharks are awesome, but I really like snails.
Yeah, you don't hear that one every day.
I do, like, I get it. Sharks are big and cool and sweet, and yes, obviously I want to swim with them in the wild all the time, but there's something really respectable about a snail, you know, the day-to-day life of it. And when people actually ask me to describe my job, I say, listen, I work very hard and I come in early, I leave late, I try my best, but I will never be good at cleaning the tanks as a snail is. Ever. They're amazing. They're an evolutionary marvel.
Except for the fact that if you tip them over. Yeah. Except for the fact that if some of them fall over, I've learned that they can't flip themselves back up.
Oh no, which one?
Do you remember which one?
Astria are not especially good at that.
Yeah, Astria.
Really?
Yeah, apparently they're not good flippers.
Okay, we're gonna do an experiment on this.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're gonna put Trochus 10 in a row.
Good because they're really good at it, flipping themselves back.
We're gonna watch it. So a woman that I went to the same college as, I met her at a conference, and she has Genonia snails. Have you ever seen these snails? So they're rare. So she works down Gulf Coast of Florida. And my cousin found just a shell from one of these snails once and gotten the paper for it.
Wow.
So they're like a deeper water, really cool. And they eat olive snails, which is one of my favorite species of snails because they're just awesome to watch. And I love seeing their trails. And, you know, the proboscis is up and they're hunting. And, oh, God. And then they come up and they find something, usually another snail, to eat and just pull it back down into the depths with them. It's so cool. But so she was telling me about all these Genonia snails they have. And that, I think about that conversation sometimes. That was one of my most favorite conversations. So, yeah, I think snails are awesome. And long story short, I like invertebrates a lot. And I wish I worked with all different species of them. And sometimes, you know, I get angry at them. Like when I freshly change the water of a tank and all the diadema think that, yes, now I will spawn.
Yeah.
That's aggravating. But you love them anyway. Mm-hmm. So I do have a tank with those guys. I've got some Bangai cardinals, a leopard wrasse who really just wants to find a man. we keep trying to order her a male and he keeps not showing up alive. So one of these days we're going to get that because I would love to try to breed those guys.
Yeah.
I've got shrimpfish who I've watched breed and release eggs. And that's another goal of mine because those guys are funny and so cool. The cuttlefish, what else? Just a random hodgepodge tank. At one point it had, I really wanted to make sand dollars work in it and sand dollars did not work in it, but I want to try again. I will not give up. But right now it's just some toadfish in there. There's a batfish. I do like walking batfish. Those guys are fun. And what else? A lot of cold water inverts. I do take care of the wolf eels right now. So if we ever get another GPO, I'll take care of that. I like those guys. Octopus are awesome. And then I do coverage for quarantine and right now our sea turtle rescue. So those guys are aggravating. So, you know, they come in, they're really sick every winter and it's awesome. It's a great program to do, but every year when they're not better immediately, I'm ready for them to be better and go back out into the ocean. They just like to bite each other and poop everywhere. So, you know, not ideal.
What was the species of turtle that was there again? I don't know.
Oh, Kemp's. We had Kemp's Ridley. Yeah. Well, okay. Were you there with the Kemp's or the loggerheads? Big or small?
They were small.
Then those were Kemp's.
Yeah, for some reason I thought you did have a loggerhead. You might have had one. Is that never a
thing? We had one green.
Maybe that was it. I thought, yeah.
A little bubble butt.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And he was in like the bigger system, right?
Harbor's still chilling.
Yeah, he just floats around. And so he has an issue with his something and it makes him float, right? Or something like that.
Yeah, so greens, a lot of times, they're in those shallow seagrass beds, and they'll get rammed by a boat. That air just gets trapped right under their carapace, and usually it's at the lower end, the butt end, and then the butt pops up, bubble butt. But with him, he also suffered some partial paralysis, too, so he's got that working against him. But I tell you what, I've seen that turtle look perfectly like a turtle, gliding through the water at the bottom, getting food, staying flat. So
your thing is just faking?
Yeah, I do. I think he's faking it. I honestly think that it's like any other injury. When you're kind of crutching along for so long, you just get used to that.
Mm-hmm.
So part of me thinks that that's how he's just used to swimming. That's how he's just used to floating almost. And why change? He's got food. He's got a place to sleep. He's got a place to swim. He's got no other turtles around bothering him. So he's fine.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Sea turtles, I just think, if they have even the slightest chance, you know, of just send them out there. Just send them out. Just see what they do.
Yeah.
But I get it. There's a lot of very intelligent people that make these decisions. So for now, Harbor is still with us.
Just doing his thing.
Yeah. And he is a great conversation piece for conservation. So sure. He's doing a great job being an ambassador,
because
mm-hmm. that's the one thing you notice, right? In zoos and aquariums, those are the kinds of animals that people flock to.
Yeah.
And they might come for the turtle, but then you kind of squeak in some cuttlefish, and that's, you know, then you're like, oh, well, if you like, it's like the gateway species, really. That's how we lure you in. And then we get you interested in all the other stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's funny you say that too, because with living in Pittsburgh and me, similar situation. I grew up in Ontario, Canada, where we have the Great Lakes, but we don't have the ocean. And my family is not like an outdoorsy family or like when they go to the beach, it's more for like margaritas, not for the sea turtles. but I'm a little of both now, so whatever. But
I was gonna say, yeah. That sounds great.
But like with the aquarium stuff and me kind of learning, same with you, like looking through an aquarium is what got me interested in aquatic ecosystems, which turned me into what I did at school and eventually with my career. And like, what do you think is the role that big aquariums play in kind of like, because there's so much negativity around big aquariums lately because of, you know, large mammals and things like that. Where do you see this kind of sitting?
Yeah, and I honestly understand how those conversations came to be, and I respect that conversations like that, difficult conversations like that, should be had and need to be had across all platforms, you know, with all people involved. And if we don't have trust from the public, then, you know, why are we there? For me, I know, because I grew up as that, you know, city kid who wouldn't have seen it otherwise, I know how life-changing they can be. And I know that a lot of the kids in Pittsburgh still need access
mm-hmm.
to this zoo, to this aquarium. And that's, you know, that's the norm. It is rare, you know, most of the United States is landlocked. Most of it is not coastal. And what we care about is what we know and what we see and what is, you know, not only close to our hearts, but close to our eyes. It's what we feel affected by, essentially. And zoos and aquariums are how the conversation of conservation started in the first place. And I hope that we don't lose sight of that. And I hope that we don't lose sight of how we got here, which was, you know, really from zoos and aquariums. Some of the history is troubled. Some of the past is troubled, absolutely. And we need to not just brush that under the rug, right? We need to talk about that, learn from it, and grow from it. But I look at these kids in the city where I live, and, you know, they just, they need us and we need to do more for them. Like, no institution is perfect and every single institution could be doing more. And that's kind of why I love these conversations, right? Because it keeps everyone accountable mm-hmm. and it keeps everyone on their toes. And then they start to ask these questions. How can I be more involved in things like C-Corps and not just community conservation, but global conservation? And then you get kids in here that all of a sudden, next time they're walking in the park and they see a snake, they're not gonna want to hurt that snake. They're gonna wanna walk around that snake mm-hmm. and they're not afraid anymore.
Yeah.
And just those small, you know, things are so life-changing for people. Mm-hmm. And I can't emphasize this enough. We're not perfect. And no institution is, but there's a reason that people like, this kind of sound, I don't want to sound weird, but there's a reason like people like me end up in places like this. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not doing it for the money or the cool clothes or the great pay and you know, great hours. Mm-hmm. We're doing it because we honestly think this is how we can help. And I think we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, for sure. And like, it's, I forget what that old saying was, Ian, but that I used to have this saying that I used to say all the time, but it was something along the lines of like, you know, when you get a chance to interact with something or you see something alive and it becomes real, it becomes something that's off of a page or something that's, you know, slithering through the bushes to your reference your snakes and stuff like that. Like when you have a, when you really interact and you see it with, like a big one is, it's funny that you say that because I see it all the way from little kids to grown men. And I work right now. Yeah. Right now I'm in my day job. I'm working on a construction site doing the environmental stuff. Right. So I always feel like I'm like pushing a ball up a hill sometimes with people who don't seem to care at all. And sometimes it's not working under a conservation lens. You're trying to, you know, facilitate construction while still protecting the environment. But anyway, with the interaction thing, we try to like bring, so we have endangered snakes around here. It's a big deal. So we've had guys on site that, you know, they come in, they'd say, you know, if I see a snake, I'm running over with a lawnmower. Right. And then that's like the way they act. And then we bring these snakes in and we like have people come and check them out and stuff like that. And all of a sudden people's like, you can see it literally in their face, like change, like they're holding it. They're like, wow, this thing's so cool. Like I kind of want a snake their whole mentality changes. So it's like,
I totally agree. Favorite quotes from David Attenborough is no one will protect what they don't care about and no one will care about what they've never experienced. I think that's incredibly true.
That is the one.
Yeah. So. Yeah, we're very visual and emotional people. So just getting to, you know, look at these animals and then read about their story, it, you know, it changes everything. I look just in my lifetime how conservation has changed so drastically because of the internet. Mm-hmm. Everybody cares so much more now because I'm living in Pittsburgh, it doesn't mean I don't know what's going on in Florida, in the Caribbean, in the Philippines. So it's really nice that we're all so connected and that we can all understand. But I think what people need to realize is we are very privileged to have this amount of information and access to it. Mm-hmm. But we cannot forget about those kids that don't have that access to it. And I think that, you know, zoos and aquariums need to not forget about them either and be more open to those kids. So our zoo has some free days for the community mm-hmm. and they can come and experience us that way. We need more of that. We really need to get these kids who's, you know, they don't see the ocean at all, or even a lake or a river or anything, they need to come in and learn that not only is this stuff cool, but that it needs to be protected. And that just because they're not on a beach doesn't mean what they do doesn't impact that beach.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and I do think we're trying. We can't be too hard on ourselves. I do think we're trying.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I guess like with the breeding programs and all that kind of stuff that happens at different zoos, like, do you think that the kind of, like, what is your kind of favorite part about working with a big zoo compared to, like, if you were trying to, I don't know how to phrase this, but basically, what programs do you like to be involved in the most with Pittsburgh? Like, what do you find fulfilling with the, is it the, I don't know how much you like the turtle program, but the breeding, seems like you like to breed stuff, turtles.
I do like rehab a lot. I do like rescue and rehab. And I used to volunteer with local wildlife rehab, and that was my favorite. So being a part of the Sea Turtle program is nice because that's the closest I get to that. And it is cool. And I'm glad that we're helping out these sea turtles. I'm not that mean of a person. And I definitely like breeding. And my favorite part about the job is that every day is a little different. Mm-hmm. And I used the word tinkering before, and it's true. I just love that I can always try different things. Mm-hmm. So if for like cuttlefish, for example, so let's try to raise this group of cuttlefish on all live food, this group of cuttlefish on all frozen food, does that make a difference? Who lives longer? Who breeds more? Who grows bigger? Those things are so interesting to me. And now let's do that with shrimp. So let's grow these up on this kind of algae. Let's grow these up on that kind of algae. Did that work? And then the coolest things are usually accidental, right? Like, oh, I've got these eggs that I pulled out, but I really don't have the time. So I'm just kind of going to throw them in there with some green algae. And then you'll come back and something will have happened. Life will have happened. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting that way. And getting to tinker with all the different, setups. So I must have had probably four different setups for raising the grass shrimp before I found the one that I liked the most and that worked the best. And it's grass shrimp, right? They basically raise themselves. It's not hard, but it's fun. It's interesting. And it's, I don't know, you feel like a little mad scientist. It's really cool to be kind of self-sustaining when you're in Pittsburgh, because mm-hmm. when you're in Florida, you just take a net, you go outside, scoop up grass shrimp. Well, I'm going to go feed them out. So to do that here is really cool, because then you say, okay, so what else can I do that with, so that I don't have to not only spend the money on shipping, right, but use the fuel and right, cause the pollution and to do that. So it's interesting that way. And that's kind of where aquariums are right now, right? We're trying to breed a lot of stuff on our own, to not take as much from the ocean. And it's fascinating, you know, what institutions are able to do, and universities too. And the kids that are coming up into it these days, aquaculture is really booming right now in a very interesting way, and I'm so excited to see where it goes. I don't know that I'll work in a zoo and aquarium forever. I don't. For me, it was a great place to start, and it's still a great place to be, but I just need to always be doing something that I feel has an impact and gives me a purpose. So for sure I recommend it. But I think I could probably you know, be happy doing most things that involve shrimp in some way.
Yeah. One of the things that I've really gotten obsessed with was, I definitely love aquaculture. Not that I don't love it, but more so like I never really been too involved with like ornamental fish breeding and stuff like that. But I was involved a lot with salmon aquaculture and trying to do it in sustainable ways, like low density farming, native fish farming, all those types of things. And one thing that I see growing in that area in big ways is like multi-trophic systems. Mm-hmm. Or have you ever heard of aquaponics?
Mm-hmm.
So this is like, it's funny you say this because like I've been talking to my friend every day trying to figure out ways that I can start a little aquaponics system in the back of his farmer's market. And that multi-trophic system, and I think even with breeding of ornamental fish, it's already hard enough to breed fish like saltwater aquarium fish. So we might not be there yet, but this idea of, you know, raising fish here, raising shrimp here, which is helping with the fish, and then growing some kelp over here, which is help feeding the shrimp, and doing all those things so that the net loss or the net amount of pollution, I guess, is really, really minimal.
Yeah,
it's pretty awesome. It's something like I can see zoos really getting involved in big aquariums, like taking on that research, because it's a big area I see really growing.
I know, it's very exciting, even in the restaurant industry too. I started to hear talk of that being used.
Mm-hmm.
To get food for restaurants, and this was even in Ohio and Pennsylvania, so, you know, Midwest states in the U.S. So that's really cool, and I'm excited to see where that goes.
Mm-hmm. And this wouldn't be the For the Reef podcast if we didn't talk a little bit about corals. So how's the corals? What's the coral situation over at PBG?
Okay, so I don't know, when you were here, we had the two grow out tanks in that one area, right?
Yes.
And it was like one Caribbean and then one was Indo-Pacific.
Yep. And there was one, I remember there was one big reef. I think it had live corals in it for some reason. Like it was a big reef.
Yeah, so we actually surplused, I think, all of the Caribbean coral that we have.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Nice. So we just went down to the one, just the one Indo-Pacific in the back, and then the Indo-Pacific tank on exhibit. So the, you know, you kind of, what's interesting about older buildings is, so sometimes if they like leak from the roof, for example, you're going to be like, I don't want inverts in that tank.
Mm-hmm.
But you can put some stuff in there that, like, you know, just put a tarp above it, put some, you know, fish in there. They'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
So the Caribbean coral tank is no more. We still have the Indo-Pacific coral tank, and we still have Paul Savaggio, who's the photographer for Seacore.
Mm-hmm.
So he's still there, and they were originally going to do new graphics for the Caribbean coral tank, so now they're not doing those anymore. But the Indo-Pacific coral tank is doing fine, and we still have the grow out in the back. We have surplus some of those guys too, and I can't remember how many aquariums those went out to. I can't remember, but we still have a good amount. Mm-hmm. So we just have the one tank, which is nice.
Do you get into that tank? Like, is that, I'm trying to remember, is that tank big enough to dive
yeah,
in?
Yeah, you have to get in there, yeah.
Oh yeah, so you're doing that?
I don't take care of it anymore, but I will dive it if needed, yes. Nice. Yeah, so it is a lot nicer to dive a coral tank than, you know, a Pacific Coast tank,
right.
Northern Pacific Coast tank.
Yeah, yeah, true.
That's so, yeah, awesome. I'll dive it if I have to.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I think, yeah, I think they're doing fine. I'm trying to think if we're doing anything interesting with those guys, but I can't think of anything. You'll just have to come see it. Yeah. You'll probably look at it and it'll look so different to you, but it probably looks the same to me.
Yeah, if I have to. I'll
yeah, we still it. Have the giant clam, so you can come see. You can see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like those guys.
So at the beginning, you mentioned that as the cuttlefish are moving out, new guys are moving in. And what are those guys and what's the plan?
So spiny lump suckers.
Okay.
So picture like a little tiny fuzz ball, but cuter and underwater, and they breed like rabbits, and they like, you know, moderately cold water, and, you know, yay big, and like a yellowish color, and just the cutest thing you've ever seen in your entire life, basically, with spiny lump suckers.
So just looked them up. They're tiny.
They're so tiny. And they're one of the fish that are really easy to breed in captivity. So we're lucky enough that people are like, yeah, we have too many. You want some? And we're like, yes, absolutely. We want some. We want some so bad.
Those are really interesting. We'll have to post a picture on there, Mitch.
Yeah, everyone who's listening, go Google spiny lump sucker. But don't do it if you're
crazy. Yeah. Please Google spiny lump suckers. Everyone, make that like the really, number one search.
They really are cute. That's funny. Like you think with a name like spiny lump sucker, it's obviously going to be cute.
Yeah, they're adorable. I mean, some fish have amazing names, like Fuzzy Nuts, for example. Another fish I've wanted to take care of. Slippery Dick. That's a classic.
I'm not Googling either one of those things.
Yeah. Might come back a little different.
Yeah.
You can Google Coral Croucher instead of Fuzzy Nut if you'd like.
So is there is there any official research that goes on at your zoo, or is it more like your own internal experiments and stuff like that?
Oh, I know. I wish. We need to be cooler. Yes, so research can take place. So a lot of it's just for our own personal enjoyment, and then we can kind of take what happened and present it at a conference. Or have you ever heard of Drum and Croker?
No.
You guys would love Drum and Croker. it comes out every year. It's just a journal. It's all online and you can go back through the archives. I think Pete Mohan is the one, he has to be one of the original ones that started it. He's from the Akron Zoo. Incredible dude, kind of retired now, but like I hope not because he's awesome. But I think he still runs it though. And there is some cool stuff that has been published in Drum and Croker, really interesting stuff. So a lot of stuff ends up on there, and then, at conferences, people are always presenting what they've learned. So some of the things that we've tried over the years at the aquarium that come to mind are, have you ever heard of using like tilapia skin to cover like skin wounds, for example? So we tried doing that on a shark. We used tilapia skin to cover one of its wounds. It didn't work very well. Boy, was it cool to try.
Yeah.
We just couldn't get it to stay on. So a lot of people will apply Neosporin, for example, to like a cut.
I've heard that done in aquarium fish.
Yeah. So how do you make that work for fish? Mm-hmm. So we use it's like a polyox powder. And we use that people have come up with, all sorts of very interesting things. And then you find the people that have learned that, you know, stingrays get bored. They like things to play with. Which kinds of instruments will be a little more natural for them that they'll be interested in playing with things like that. Or, you know, wolf eels, for example, how do you get them to open their mouths for you so you can check their teeth out? There's always so many interesting things to do. I'm trying to think of anything that we've done recently, mostly just the tilapia skin. Recently, we had COVID kind of messed a lot of stuff up, mm-hmm. which was a bit of a bummer for us.
Yeah, for sure.
But at aquarium, I'm just going to talk about people that are doing cool stuff that aren't in Pittsburgh. So there's an aquarium in Minnesota that they 3D printed a strap for a sea turtle that had the positive buoyancy, you know, the bubble butt. And they, you know, people try different methods of adhering the weights to the back or strapping them on with neoprene. They made like a form fitted, like a book bag. They 3D printed it. How cool is that? We were in Pittsburgh. We were 3D printing different, Mitch, what are those things called that they put on when they're regrowing a reef for the corals to grow on? You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, like
the little
blocks and stars and whatever they are.
Yeah, I know I know like Seacor's calling them substrates now, but they before they used to call them I forget. I know what you're talking about. The bases that
geometric shapes that they attach the larvae to. Yeah.
Right.
So have you guys ever noticed that coralline algae will always grow where you don't want it to grow before it grows where you want it to grow? Mm-hmm. So they were messing around with, okay, what can I build this out of that little larval coral will be like, yeah, I want to settle there. Like, that's mm-hmm. a good spot. So they were trying different materials for that. They were throwing those in one of the coral grow out tanks for a while. They were doing that. I don't know if anything ever came of that though.
I actually have one of those in this tank back here.
is it working?
It's growing. Stuff's growing on top of it. It's covered
in coralline. Literally, all the adductors were always like covered in coraline, and I'm like, mm-hmm. why here? Mm-hmm. Don't grow there.
And I wouldn't sell yourself short. You're doing all that breeding there. Yeah. So maybe you should publish that.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe one day. You just need
a ghostwriter. I'm not running around.
Yeah. Just get somebody like, I'm sure there's some little Justine who came in the zoo after COVID and she's gonna be like, I'll do anything. I just wanna be a marine biologist. Like, get over here, kid, you're gonna follow me around for the next 3 weeks.
I tell you what, we get some really good interns.
True, I bet you do.
We really do. We get some interns, I'm like, we don't deserve you. Like, go live your life. Mm-hmm. But yeah, people, it really does restore your faith in humanity, right? People really want to help out. They really want to make the world a better place. It's nice. I know. Yeah. I should write some stuff down, right? One day.
Videos are even easier. And you just put them out in cyberspace and see what you
know. I did used to take a lot of videos for my cousin's class. She taught, I think it was third grade. And I would send them a video every week.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. They were in Denver.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm. They were in Denver. And it was the same thing. These kids, they, you know, they don't know any of this stuff. And so you start them off with, like, a penguin, right? You're like, hey, kid, check out this penguin. And once you get their attention, you're like, okay, but look at this crab. Uh-huh. That's what's cool.
Yeah.
Switch. The old bait and switch.
Yeah. Here's a shark, here's a snail.
Right? Yeah. Just slide it in there.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Sneaky conservation. Oh, that could be the name of my video.
Oh, I can just see it.
Conservation.
I can see it now. Actually, I volunteered at an aquarium. This would have been a while ago. I was at Belle Isle Aquarium in Detroit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think it's the oldest aquarium in the US. Don't quote me on that.
Makes sense.
I'm pretty sure So it's a really small aquarium, like literally like tanks built from concrete into the walls, big like mosaic green ceiling. It's a beautiful aquarium. If anyone's around that area, go check it out because it's really cool. And another like, you know, really low budget, you know, like just small scale aquarium that brings in a lot of native species and tries to do everything they can. So
yeah,
I went there and volunteered for a while, and I finally got to the point where the guy trusted me enough, like the main curator, main aquarist, whoever, he trusted me to put together a sea lamprey tank. Have you ever seen those guys?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I have.
Yeah. So everything went pretty good.
Gnarly yeah. things.
Yeah. And the water has to be pretty cold. So we were like using fans to blow up the glass. And I don't know what you guys use, but we had like these heated fans that blew the front, blew the glass so it didn't condensate. But little Mitch decided, you know, to go grab rocks from outside, because I'm like, there's no rocks in here. I got to make the aquarium look more natural. And like, I watched way too many aquascaping videos back in the day. So I went and got a bunch of rocks. And
I'm so excited for this.
Some of them I think were like limestone, crushed limestone. So
okay.
I'm sure some people are thinking, oh no, Mitch, that's going to make the water really alkaline. So that's what I did anyway. And I went and took all these rocks and I put them into the tank. And I was monitoring the sea lampreys, which starting to look a little weird. And then all of a sudden the guy comes over, he goes, where did you get those rocks? And this guy's amazing. Like, I'm not trying to knock him down, but he's like, where'd you get all these rocks? I'm like, in the parking lot. You idiot. So we took the rocks out and saved the lamprey. But that was, you know, it was one of my favorite aquarium stories. But same thing at that aquarium. I noticed all the aquarists, there was the front display, and then there was like, for the real fish nerds, everything in the back. And you go into the back and you'll find a few little tinkering tanks, and they had a lot of fresh water.
We're like
fish.
A mullet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Business in the front.
Yeah.
Party in the back.
Party in the back. Yeah. For sure.
I like to go on the behind the scenes tour every aquarium I've been to, because that's where all the cool stuff is.
Oh yeah.
Long Beach Aquarium, so, and stuff like that. They had all sorts of, like, they were breeding, I believe, what do they call it? Leafy sea dragons out back.
Oh, yeah. Those
that was
are,
super cool.
Talk about a diva species. Mm. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. But so cool. So what is the coolest aquarium you've ever been to?
Pittsburgh. PBG. I'm a little shattered. Ian, you go first.
I think I like Long Beach. That was one of my favorites, just because to go in the back and like they really took their time and took you through all the little experiments they were doing. Maybe it was just for me because I was asking questions, but it seemed like, as opposed to going to sort of like Ripley's and Toronto's and stuff, you don't get to see the same. To me, like, out front is nice, but I want to see the cool stuff. What are you really doing?
Yeah.
For me, it's got, okay. So I've been to Georgia, dove in the Georgia Aquarium's whale shark tank. That was nuts. and that, so like, that was bucket list by a million. I really love Ripley's, because shout out to Canada, and Canada needs more aquariums. But Ripley's like Toronto in general is just so expensive, and space is so limited, but
it's very busy.
And Ripley or Toronto is definitely an area where you get a lot of concrete locked kids that never see anything.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with Ripley's aquarium. I'm not bashing it at all by any means. It's fantastic, but it's not the same experience.
See, but I thought that what they did with the amount of space is awesome, and they have one tank in there. Well, they have a couple tanks in there. Like, the one that I like a lot is you can stand under and you just look at like the silhouette of schooling sardines. I think they're sardines.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so you just get to like see them. And that's like one of my favorite things about diving, is if you ever can get under the animals and you're just watching them kind of cruise by doing their traffic thing. It's just like, whoa, like you're just a speck of sand, you know?
It's hard to compare the aquariums because they all have something unique to offer.
Yeah, Shed That's Aquarium's true. Also amazing.
Shed's awesome. Yeah. I went to the one.
Shed. Talk about an old aquarium.
Yeah.
I went to the one in Boston. I've been to the one in Denver. Mm-hmm. I try and go wherever we go. They've all got something unique about them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there one that you're like, I need to go see that aquarium? Like you talked about bucket list diving in Georgia. Okay, what's the next bucket list aquarium? Where do we have to go next?
Monterey Bay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd love to see that one. I'd also really like to see that one in, like, it's in Japan.
There's one I've seen pictures of in Dubai that looks really cool. Like in
Dubai,
multi-stories. Yeah. That looks pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're doing some cool stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's highly unlikely I'm getting to Dubai, but I'd still like to see it.
Yeah. We'll casually go one day.
Yeah. Even
maybe they'll invite you because they'll want the podcast to come.
I
forgot to tell you. Yeah, we got a bunch of messages from Dubai. We're gonna head there soon.
Yeah. This was the reason you guys created this podcast.
Right.
That's the end game. Can you see it now?
Just remember
where you started.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The New Orleans has an aquarium.
Oh yeah,
too.
Yeah. I forgot about that one.
And usually, like
Audubon.
Yeah, Audubon. That one's. I love that aquarium just because they just highlight native species really well. But
yeah, that's a cool space.
Yeah. Totally.
So. Nice location. They also have a really cool insectarium, like on the same block as the aquarium. 10 out of 10 recommend.
Really?
Hmm.
Yeah. You don't think that insects are that crazy cool, but oh my goodness, they are.
Terrifying. That's one thing with the, I'm not a bug guy, I must say.
Yeah, okay. Me neither.
Oh, I mean, I scream every time I see a centipede. It's the reason I got married, really, yeah. I think. So I understand, but like leaf bugs are some of the coolest things ever. True. They're like chameleons, but a bug.
That's true.
So cool. That's just awesome. I love them. And then there's, you know, assassin beetles. That's just a respectable bug. You don't get called an assassin beetle for nothing.
Yep. And we can't rule out all the saltwater benthic invertebrates and all the creepy crawlies that you find in aquariums. You must have found some pretty crazy stuff. And is there any like big old creepies you found?
Just like you've probably seen videos, right, of old tanks, and you find like the biggest bristle worm you've ever seen in your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I've my coworker on more than one occasion has taken bristle worm bristles out of me.
Mm-hmm.
So I get that a lot. Usually just bristleworms, though. I don't find a ton of other crazy stuff. Really just bristleworms. I mean, we are in Pittsburgh, so sometimes you do find like a cockroach or a centipede floating in the top of your tank, and that's unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
Unpleasant, very, very unpleasant. No, other than like the bugs that, you know, the fish will get, nothing else too crazy.
Do you get into treating your fish a lot? Is that that's always a big topic?
Yeah. So we have a just one tank with monogeons right now, actually. So it's a rainbow fish, archer fish, where the big Australian lungfish is. Do you remember that tank?
Mm-hmm.
So they had some monogeons right now, so we're treating them. Luckily all those kind of like ecto, like skin and gill parasites are normally pretty easy going. So we can treat those. And it is very interesting to see when you have a couple of fish that are looking off and then you put them on that treatment and it's, you know, night and day. It's nice to see that. Cause not, you know, they don't all bounce back from that. So veterinary medicine, can go a lot further with fish because they're just starting to kind of get into it. Okay, what can we do? What can we, you know, treat these guys with? So because, you know, it's harder to work on a fish than it is you know, a skunk. So there's that. So Yeah. Or even like an anemone.
Yeah.
Can you ultrasound an anemone? You can. It's very different, but you can.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be a good topic one day. Let's talk about marine veterinary work. I wonder who we can get.
I bet Rob Jones would talk to you.
Sure.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Aquarium vet. There you go. Yeah,
that'd be fantastic.
To the moon. Yeah, I mean, and next Dubai.
Yeah.
But anyway, Justine, I don't want to take up too much of your time. It was really awesome catching up with you, and as always, you know, you're really fun to chat with.
Yeah.
You're your passion and
thanks
a lot.
We will have to give you a call. We were supposed to have gone down to Cayman twice to three times this year to work with the eco divers. I was just talking to Aaron a couple of days ago. He's going to come on again in a week or so, and he's got some folks at CCMI, Central Caribbean Marine Institute, where he's going to hook us up with, and the DOE in Cayman. But he's a fascinating guy. I think you two would gel amazingly. So when we go down, you'll have to bring your husband and come down and hang out with us and work with the divers for a week or so.
I mean, if I have to, I have to.
I think you'll really like it.
For sure. Yeah, we were listening to the last podcast over dinner, actually, he was on. Yeah. Yeah,
he's a fantastic guy. So he's going to come on.
Like, I wish I sounded like that.
He's going to come on. I think he said maybe sometime this week or next week, we're going to talk to him. He's going to talk about sort of how the islands reacted to COVID and the lockdown, and they're dealing with some stony coral tissue loss disease down there right now and things like that. So he comes on every so often and gives us an update on the work that they're doing down there.
That's amazing. You guys are cool. it's a pleasure.
All right, well, and I wish, I'm forgetting, what are your dog's names again?
Oh, Murray and Zeppelin.
It was also really nice to meet Murray and Zeppelin.
Yeah.
And you had a sweet name too. Yeah. Axel.
So at the beginning of the podcast, we were showing each other dogs. Totally normal.
I'm waiting for him to get Slash.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, you should. We had axolotls, and one was named Axel, one was named Rose.
Oh, nice. Sorry. Nice. Good. All right. So, anyway, have a great night. Thanks a lot, Justine.
Thank you, Justine.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
See ya.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the For the Reef podcast. As always, you can reach us at ForTheReefPodcast@gmail.com or via our websites, ForTheReef.com or SustainableMarineCanada.ca. If you would like to get involved and help the reef restoration efforts, check out our friends at CaymanEcoDivers.com. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Please hit subscribe and join us for the next episode coming soon.